This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, September 18th, 2013. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, a poem that's anything but sweet. The recent sarin gas attacks in Syria killed many hundreds of men, women, and children, and got the world thinking again about the horror of chemical weapons. Inevitably, it makes one think of World War I, when chlorine, mustard gas, and other agents were first used in battle on a massive scale. The world was horrified then, too, and demoralized. As Thomas Hardy put it, 2,000 years of mass, we've got as far as poison gas. Thomas Hardy was too old to fight in World War I, but Wilfred Owen wasn't. Before he was killed, just a week before the war ended, he wrote some of the most vivid war poems in the language, including one explicitly about poison gas. I'm going to talk to Bonnie Costello about that poem. Bonnie Costello is a professor at Boston University whose field is American modern and contemporary poetry. Bonnie, you're not a Wilfred Owen scholar, but I know that you have taught this poem in one of your classes. Wilfred Owen wrote quite a number of very good war poems, so why did you have your students read Dulce et Decorum Est in particular?
Well, in fact, we read many of Wilfred Owen's poems.
Mm-hmm.
You have to remember also that he died at around age 25, so there aren't as many poems as we would have liked. But this is probably his most famous poem. He actually started out rather differently. He started out as a kind of latter-day Keats, and he wrote a poem visiting Keats's house and so on. And then the war experience completely changed him as a poet. And when he put his poems together, he included this statement that had a huge impact on the poets who came after him.
Hmm.
He said, "Above all, I am not concerned with poetry. My project is war and the pity of war. The poetry is in the pity. All a poet can do today is warn. That is why the true poets must be truthful." And I think that comes through very strongly, both the warning and the pity.
Yeah, it certainly does. And we'll hear that in the recording we're about to hear. It's read by the actor Michael Stuhlbarg. I wanted to ask you first, because I think it's important to understand this poem, what does Dulce et Decorum Est mean, and where does it come from?
Well, it's a Latin phrase from Horace,
mm-hmm.
and it means it is sweet and proper to die for one's country.
And in Horace, that is said unironically, I would imagine.
That's right. And of course, here it's the title, and it comes back at the end of the poem.
Yeah, and a completely different meaning by the time we get to the end of the poem. But let's hear it, and then we'll talk about it and go through it later. Here's Michael Stuhlbarg reading Dulce et Decorum Est by Wilfred Owen.
Bent double, like old beggars under sacks, knock-kneed, coughing like hags, we cursed through sludge, till on the haunting flares we turned our backs and toward our distant rest began to trudge. Men marched asleep. Many had lost their boots, but limped on bloodshod. All went lame, all blind, drunk with fatigue, deaf even to the hoots of gas shells dropping softly behind. Gas, gas, quick, boys! An ecstasy of fumbling fitting the clumsy helmets just in time. But someone still was yelling out and stumbling and floundering like a man in fire or lime. Dim through the misty panes and thick green light, as under a green sea, I saw him drowning. In all my dreams before my helpless sight, he plunges at me, guttering, choking, drowning. If in some smothering dreams you too could pace behind the wagon that we flung him in, and watch the white eyes writhing in his face, his hanging face, like a devil's, sick of sin. If you could hear at every jolt the blood come gargling from the froth-corrupted lungs, bitten as the cud of vile, incurable sores on innocent tongues. My friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory the old lie, dulce et decorum est, pro patria mori.
Bonnie, poems are almost always in conversation with other poems, and the conversation here is virtually explicit. At the end, he says, "My friend, you would not tell with such high zest the children ardent for some desperate glory, the old lie." Who is the friend there? Who is he addressing this poem to?
Well, in the narrowest sense, it's someone named Jesse Pope, who wrote heroic poems mostly for adolescents. I can read you a little bit of one if you have the time.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's called Who's for the Game. I'll just read you the beginning and the end of it. You can get a sense of the kind of thing that Wilfred Owen is reacting to.
Mm-hmm.
Who's for the game, the biggest that's played, the red crashing game of a fight? Who'll grip and tackle the job unafraid, and who thinks he'd rather sit tight? And then it ends, you'll earn the empire's thanks, will you, my laddie? Who'll swell the victor's ranks? Will you, my laddie? When that procession comes, banners and rolling drums, who'll stand and bite his thumbs? Will you, my laddie?
So he's writing in response to this very patriotic pro-war poetry written by some of his fellow poets.
Absolutely. I mean, Rupert Brooke, of course, wrote a very famous poem called The Soldier. You know, if I should die, think only this of me, that there's some corner of a foreign land that is forever England, and goes on. It's very famous. But, of course, he did die in World War I. But the rhetoric went on.
So Wilfred Owen is deep in the trenches. He's seen the worst of World War I. But what is his argument here exactly? The reality of war should dampen anyone's enthusiasm for it? Or is it that poison gas in particular makes it a lie that it is sweet and fitting to die for one's country? Is it anti-war or anti-poison gas, or is it just both?
Well, I believe it's anti-heroic idealism.
Oh, because there's no chance for heroism when you're just being gassed.
Yeah, well, even before you're gassed. I mean, the first images are not the images of Jesse Pope's football game. They are the images of a dehumanized mass.
Yeah, he begins the poem, the soldiers are not retreating, they're going away from the front for a rest.
Exactly.
They're already in pretty poor shape.
Men marched asleep. Many had lost their boots, but limped on bloodshod.
That's an incredible image right there.
Bloodshod.
That is very vivid, to say the least.
Well, it's not only vivid, it turns people into animals.
Right.
We don't usually talk about ourselves as being shod.
All went lame, all blind, drunk with fatigue, deaf even to the hoots of gas shells dropping softly behind.
And then they quickly put on their gas masks.
An ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time. But someone still was yelling out and stumbling and floundering like a man in fire or lime. Dim through the misty panes and thick green light, as under a green sea, I saw him drowning.
The metaphor here is drowning and in a sea. Is it that the gas was greenish? What's going on here?
Well, I think the gas is greenish. Also, it affects the lungs.
Mm-hmm.
And when the lungs are affected, it's a drowning sensation. So it's both inside and outside. Also, I think one of the things that's happening between the first and second stanzas is that there's something very powerful about the sound of bent double like old beggars under sacks.
Mm-hmm.
The hard sounds of the B's and the D's and the K's in there. And the rhymes of sludge and trudge, which sounds like the mud that it is. And so we're in the thick of it through sound there. And then a sudden shift as we get into the dreamlike qualities of the poem, into long E's and O's, the dim through the misty panes and thick green light. It almost sounds like a line from romantic poetry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's dreamlike. And so he creates a very different feeling there.
The dreamlike being the strange atmosphere created by the green gas.
The disorientation. You know, the pace of the poem has shifted radically, right? They've been trudging in the sludge.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, quick boys and the ecstasy of fumbling, there's a disorientation that happens that is reinforced by the imagery. But in fact, the gas did produce these clouds that obscured vision. And it's reinforced, of course, because they're all putting these iconic gas masks with their foggy lenses that everybody's got in front of their faces now, so they can't see out of them very well either. So that obscures the vision further.
And then the poet backs away from the scene itself and talks about remembering this.
In all my dreams before my helpless sight, he plunges at me, guttering, choking, drowning.
In other words, he's not going to forget this ever.
Yeah, it's a classic trauma. Wilfred Owen was hospitalized for a while, then sent back to the front and died there, of course. I think that's the kind of effect he wants here, is just this sense of, this isn't a one-time event. The participles stumbling and drowning that are part of the scene become permanent, suspended. And you've got that hanging face, too, which is like forever hanging.
If in some smothering dreams you, too, could pace behind the wagon that we flung him in, and watch the white eyes writhing in his face, his hanging face, like a devil's, sick of sin.
I found that peculiar to describe the victim's face here as being like a devil's, sick of sin. What do you make of that?
You know, first we have this marching crowd, this mass, this we, undifferentiated we. Then we have someone identified. To me, the hanging face becomes a face of war, a human face transformed into something demonic.
But sick of sin, it's interesting that it's some sort of human shame emblazoned upon the face of this dying man. And then the poem continues.
If you could hear at every jolt the blood come gargling from the froth-corrupted lungs.
That's an incredibly memorable image, froth-corrupted lungs.
Even in Kipling, really, none of the rhetoric leading up to World War One is quite so visceral that, you know, quite confronts the horror and degradation and dehumanization, even. I mean, the word cud there is, you know, well chosen.
Bitten as the cud of vile, incurable sores on innocent tongues.
As visceral and physical as it is, he's a good enough poet that he can make it do work in a couple of levels. What is he talking about here? He's talking about the mouth. He's talking about speech. He's going to go on to talk about that famous quote from Horace. The sense of incurable sores and innocent tongues. He's going to be addressing a friend who wrote heroic poetry for children.
My friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory the old lie, dulce et decorum est, pro patria mori.
Here's my one quibble with the poem. I somehow think that the rhetorical point he's making is weaker than the earlier part of the poem.
You mean when it turns into a message?
Yeah, when it turns into a clear rhetorical message, he's basically saying, no, it's not sweet and fitting to die for your country. It's something I agree with, but I can't help but think that it weakens the poem in some way. Do you agree?
Well, I think our generation, we're very used to indirection, to no ideas but in things. Wilfred Owen's writing in a culture where aphoristic statements, maxims, a kind of sententious quality in poetry is not only common but almost expected. And this is before a lot of the turn toward radical modernism. You know, it's before The Wasteland. I think he is, in a sense, working within that culture to turn its message around. I actually really like the ending. I think it's so powerful to have things so direct at that point. And also, it rescues the poem from the risk of just numbing us with the horror. Because otherwise, we're just left with that nightmare in the middle of the poem that goes on and on and on.
Yeah. Now, when I saw the video from Syria recently, there's a couple images that came up from this poem, the froth-corrupted lungs, for example. That was there. You saw that. So he in a sense, has provided some of the vocabulary for the unspeakable.
Yes, and I noted that just as W.H. Auden's poem, September 1st, 1939, was circulated during 9/11, that this poem is starting to circulate. So it's a good moment to be thinking about these things.
Bonnie, thanks so much.
No problem. Thank you.
Bonnie Costello is a professor of English at Boston University. She's currently working on a book called Private Faces in Public Places. You can read more Wilfred Owen poems on our website, poetryfoundation.org. If you have any comments on this program, email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.